From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. One in every 100 of us is behind bars. According to a Pew Center study, 2.3 million Americans are in jail or prison. That's a new record. It puts the United States first in the total number of prisoners behind bars and the proportion of people locked up. Why are the numbers so high, and should they be? Ryan King is a policy analyst for the Sentencing Project, a prison reform organization, and he's here to give us his take. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So are you surprised by these numbers? Is there anything in the report we haven't really heard before?
Unfortunately, I wish I could say I was surprised, but it's pretty much an extension of what we've known going back for decades now, and that is that our path of tougher sentencing laws and higher rates of incarceration has really continued unabated. And at this point, as this report points out, we stand alone on the global stage with really no other peers in terms of our use of incarceration.
Can you break down the numbers by race?
Well, that's where the numbers are most compelling and most frightening. The 1 in 100 number that got most of the attention, 1 in 100 Americans in prison or jail, obscures the underlying trends and the geographical concentration of incarceration, particularly among low-income communities of color. And once you look for young African-American males, as the report points out, black men between the ages of 20 and 34, 1 in 9 of them are in prison or jail on a given day.
Really, what's the root of this? Is it that Americans are out of bounds, out of control criminally? Is it that criminal justice policies are punitive in the wrong ways? What do you think is at the root of this?
Well, it's important to first point out what is not at the root of that, and that is it's not a result of a growing population, and it's not, most key of all, the result of increasing crime rates. We've seen a number of studies, all which point to the fact that this growth in incarceration over the last, really beginning at 1970, has been the result of tougher sentencing laws. And simply put, more people are going to prison than in the past. They're staying there for longer periods of time than they would have in the past. And we've essentially either abolished in some cases or virtually removed the use of parole for reducing sentence length. And so the result is more people come in, they stay in there for longer periods of time, few of them are coming out, and what we see, 1 in 100.
How much does it cost to keep people in jail, in prison, and what is it doing to other sectors like education in terms of government spending?
Well, the report points out that in the late 1980s, 1987, states were spending about $10 billion of their general revenue funds on incarceration and corrections, and now they're spending about $44 billion. And the report shows, I think, quite clearly something that a number of people have been talking about, is that this is really a zero-sum game. When you take dollars out of one pile, you're taking them away from other areas. And this report identifies a growth in the use of incarceration resources about 127% since 1987, where for higher education it's about 21%. So I think it's very clear that when we're shuffling dollars into the corrections area, we're taking them away from key areas of healthcare, of education, and other social services.
There's new news out that the Attorney General is urging judges not to retroactively allow out people who were convicted of crack cocaine. There's new sentencing guidelines that would allow them to get out if their sentences were under the old rules. Where are these battles being fought? Where are the battles over incarceration and what America's policies are being fought right now?
They're really being fought at the local level. They're being fought at the state level. Unfortunately, the federal government has never been a real leader for change except in what I would argue is the wrong direction. But states now, particularly since 2000, largely as a result of toughening budget crises, states' resources, as we mentioned earlier, are becoming very, very slim. And incarceration in many states, the prison populations are 100, 125% of capacity. So in a lot of states, legislators are coming to the table now. They're talking to policy analysts. They're talking to research and saying what else works. And the good news, the silver lining in this black cloud, is that there are a lot of alternatives to incarceration that are effective. There's a lot of research that points to other areas where we can invest our state efforts. And I'm optimistic that as the years go forward, we can broaden this conversation.
Well, Ryan, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Ryan King is a policy analyst for the Sentencing Project, and he joined us from our NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Now we've got an insider's look on making it on the outside. Joining us is Jason Soule. He's a reentry services associate for Amicus. That's a program in Minneapolis that helps former inmates build a life outside of prison. Hi, Jason.
Hello.
So, you know, we just spoke with Ryan about incarceration rates. How does it make you feel when you hear that 1 in 9 black men is in jail or prison?
It's sad. As you know, I was a inmate myself from 2000 to 2002. And it's just, I mean, we have to hold our judges, teachers, and parents more accountable. It's definitely not something I care to see in the near future. I want us to put an end to it somehow.
There's a lot of talk about whether or not jails and prisons should be rehabilitating people, whether there should be education, job training, all that stuff. What did you get when you were incarcerated? Did you get any training? Did you get any legs up on a new life?
No, I didn't. But when I went in, I set my mind to believe that I can achieve higher. You know, from day one, I realized that it wasn't the place for me. I didn't like the food. I didn't like the way I was treated. I didn't like anything about the prison system. And it didn't help me at all. So I couldn't seek higher education because I had a high school diploma. And at the time, there was no MSF. There was no places that provided funds for someone who wanted to achieve higher education. So I just educated myself and knew that I wanted better. So education is definitely the key. I believe that's the only way to combat a felony background.
Speaking of felony background, it can be really hard to get a job. What did you find when you first got out?
Well, I had the opportunity to be released on a work release program, which actually gave me 30 days to find a job. But because I've had values that were instilled in me as a child, I had a few jobs. But a lot of people that are coming out of the system have never had employment except the employment that they were given while incarcerated. So I was able to land a job in 5 days because I took, you know, the resources that were given to me, and I was just extremely aggressive, because I didn't want to fail.
Now you're working with this program, Men of Rafiki. It's part of Amicus. What exactly is that about?
Well, Rafiki is a Swahili word for friend, and Amicus is a Latin word for friend. We believe that if you show somebody that you're a friend to them and show them support and believe in them and just help them any way you can, that they can succeed. We believe that if you, the Men of Rafiki program in general, we believe that if you show someone where they've come from, they can have a better sense of where they're actually going. So it's a program that starts in the institution, and I work with them when they're, I work with them post-release.
So the program bridges between when they're in prison and then when they come out.
That's correct. It's pre- and post-release. We have someone in our office that visits the institutions, and he basically gives a pitch that we're there to work with them for a certain amount of weeks, and then they can sign up or they can reject it, and it's totally voluntary.
What's the worst or toughest thing that you've heard from someone you're working with in terms of giving up or being hostile to the whole idea that they can have a life after prison?
From what their life has shown them, they don't really see how that's even possible. Like, if you grew up in poor neighborhoods and all you seen was negativity and your mother and father, their relationship didn't work and your relationship with your significant other isn't working, you really don't have a sense of hope. So in my position, I can actually give them a sense of hope because I'm actually living the life that I want to live. So they can see that it's possible because most of my clients know me from before.
What do you mean they know you from before?
They know me when I wasn't such a nice guy. They know me when I was a gang leader and a drug dealer. And they actually seen my transformation. And they seen how hard it was for me to actually live a good, successful life without any negativity. But they're coming around to seeing that it's possible because I stand as that symbol of hope to them.
Were there any times when you thought, okay, I'm not making as much money as I used to. My status might not be the same as I used to have in the neighborhood. I really just can't keep living the straight and narrow life.
At times, but you know, it's like you always have those triggers. Like you see a nice truck riding down the street, you know, I always think back to my life before and say, dang, that truck is really nice. But it doesn't propel me to end my career and go back into a life of crime. I just know that if I stay, you know, if I stay going down the path that I'm going, that everything will be okay. Like a lot of those things I see, they're nice, but they're materialistic. And I'm okay with who I am, so I don't need those things to make me feel better. I'm okay.
What about the standpoint of this as, you know, a community issue in black neighborhoods, in urban neighborhoods? Do people have a consciousness that you talk to? I don't just mean, you know, brothers and sisters getting out of prison. I mean, people who are family members, that this has got to be a priority, that dealing with the system has to be a priority.
Not really. Most teenage African-American boys, they see it as a rites of passage. You know, most of them don't know that they should be planning for college and making realistic goals for themselves. They tend to settle for the life of crime, because in poor neighborhoods, drug dealers actually look like giants. You know, they seem successful. They have nice cars. Everybody likes them and things like that. So they don't really see going to prison as something bad. They just look at it as a part of life for African-American male.
What's going to turn that around?
More people like myself going back to those communities and saying, hey, if you end up going down this path, you're going to get shot. You're going to go to prison. It's not like you're going to end up being successful in ending the drug game with a pension, because it rarely happens. So I just go back to those communities and show them, like, hey, I've been to prison, I've been shot, I have felonies, but I took what was learned from making those mistakes, and I want to show you by not letting you go down the same path that I went down. So it takes more people who have actually made it out going back and saying, hey, you know, all you need is a support system. You need a circle of support and accountability. Because if I wasn't accountable to my family, if I wasn't accountable to my job, or if I wasn't accountable to my professors at the university, then maybe I would go back out to that life. But because I'm so structured and I have people around me that care about me, there's no way I can fail.
All right, Jason, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Jason Soule is a reentry services associate for the Amicus program, Men of Rafiki. He spoke with us from Audio Ruckus in Minneapolis. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. This week on Africa Update, in Kenya, two rival politicians sign a power-sharing agreement, but can they work together to make it a reality? And U.S. airstrikes target a suspected al-Qaeda terrorist in Somalia. For more, we've got Amira Woods. She's co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Good to have you on again.
Great to be with you, as always, Farai.
So last week, Kenya's president, Mwai Kibaki, and opposition leader Raila Odinga signed a power-sharing deal to end the post-election crisis. More than 1,000 people died in fighting since the election in late December, and former UN chief Kofi Annan helped broker the deal.
I know some of you may have wished to get more, but what you got is the best under the circumstances. Keep it for that. Sake of the broad masses of Kenya, they deserve a break. They deserve to be treated better.
They deserve to be treated better, talking about the citizens. It's all handshakes and smiles right now, but what are really the basics of this deal?
Well, the basics of the deal are to essentially share the political power between the two factions of the election. So Kibaki, who is the current president, as well as Odinga, who will be under this arrangement, the prime minister, so to speak, it is to share among their two parties both these critical roles within top leadership of government and also critical cabinet posts that will help bring forward a new ruling party in Kenya.
What was this dispute all about? Fundamentally, what are the differences between these two men on how they view how the Kenyan government should unfold and do its business?
Well, the dispute really was about the rule of law. To what extent can an election be absolutely derailed? To what extent can a judicial process be put off track by the government in power? So the Kibaki government essentially, many say, rigged the election and installed themselves as president after this flawed election. And people said no, it would not take such a process going on 8 years into this new century here. People said no. And so what you had was, even though the Bush administration was quick to congratulate Kibaki, you had the citizens of Kenya saying, we demand a different way. And the violence that erupted it was in large part because of that sense that the rule of law, the will of the people, was absolutely being ignored. So what you had was a process put forward by the African Union. So Kofi Annan, the former UN Secretary General, Graça Machel, the wife of Nelson Mandela, with all the political leverage that they bring, were able to keep all parties at the table to say, how can we stem the violence? How can we map out a path that will bring a resolution to the crisis and will bring a path to peace? So what we have is this power-sharing arrangement. It's not perfect. It still has to be endorsed by the parliament. So on Thursday, there will be a vote in the parliament in Kenya to ratify this agreement. There needs to be a change in the constitution, which is an act of parliament, before this agreement is fully in place. But that is expected to happen on Thursday. So it's seen as a critical step forward towards ending the political impasse that has brought the crisis in Kenya.
There's still some fighting over land. And one of the things that happened in this was that, you know, hundreds of thousands of people moved around the country. Some people were pushed off of their land. Some people fled. Is there a system that's being set up to really deal with those kinds of fundamental issues?
Well, that is still part of the negotiations that's actually still ongoing for ICE. So there are some elements, particularly of this, the issues of land and land redistribution, that are still being negotiated today. So there are, while political settlements have been advanced and agreements have been signed, there are still core elements that have been just burning below the surface, bubbling below the surface, ready for any crisis like this to erupt. Those land tensions in place since the days of colonialism, in place, many say, because of colonialism, Farai, those land tensions still remain. And resolution of those issues of land distribution, land redistribution for Kenya, for many countries in the world, really, still remain a quite divisive issue.
Well, let's turn to Somalia. Yesterday, three missiles hit a small Somali town about 4 miles from the Kenyan border. A house was destroyed. 8 people, including 4 kids, were seriously injured. And the Pentagon says the target was a, quote, known al-Qaeda terrorist. So the U.S. military has staged different attacks on suspected extremists in Somalia over the past year. What could the fallout from this airstrike be?
Disaster. That's the fallout, Farai. In a word, disaster. What has happened is the Bush administration has decided to pick sides. Let's remember, Somalia had really 15 years of crisis. After the end of 1991, the end of the dictator Siad Barre, Somalia went without a government for 15 years. And then back in June of 2006, a government came into being that absolutely represented a chance for peace for the first time. Yet they had a simple word in their name. It was the Union of Islamic Courts that in many ways the Bush administration saw as a threat. So although it brought peace from June to December of 2006, the Bush administration decided, no, they had too close ties with Islamists and they needed to be dislodged as a government. So those airstrikes started back in December of 2006 and continued throughout 2007, from January to April of 2007. And we see this week that the U.S. military incursions into Somali territory have not subsided. Essentially, it is an effort to destabilize Somalia. It is both the U.S. airstrikes, a U.S. naval presence offshore, off Somali's waters, as well as U.S. support to Ethiopian troops that have come into place in Somalia.
But Amira, it sounds as if you are not as concerned that there are extremists in Somalia. Is that what you're saying?
Many Somalis tell you that this was not an extreme government. Point blank. What they say is, for the first time, women were able to walk the streets without threat of being raped. People were able to send their children to school. So clearly the Bush administration saying that they're going after 3 terrorists who bombed the U.S. embassy 10 years ago does not seem like a plausible reason to launch air strikes against communities in Somalia. So what you have had is an attack on Somali civilians that has led hundreds of civilians dead. And you have had increasing resentment, not only of the Ethiopian forces that are installed there in Somalia, but also increasing resentment against the United States.
How could that resentment play out? And are people reacting today?
clearly there is much animosity growing, both against the Ethiopian troops and against the U.S. There's a sense that Somalis have to choose their own path. Again, the international community can be there to support paths towards negotiations and peaceful efforts at negotiations. But the U.S. coming in with a heavy militarist hand is seen absolutely as the wrong way to go. So there is greater instability that's likely to come out of these airstrikes and out of the decision essentially by the Bush administration to pick sides, because in this case, they may well have picked the wrong side.
Well, Amira, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Amira Woods is co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. She joined us from the Sports Byline Studios in San Francisco. Knowledge is power, but getting it can be a struggle. This next story is about how profoundly education can affect the lives of young girls in sub-Saharan Africa. Fiona Mushimberi grew up in rural Zimbabwe. Her parents were poor, they couldn't read or write, but they wanted better for her. Mushimberi went on to become a human rights lawyer. Now she's giving back as part of CAMFED, the Campaign for Female Education. Many of the girls helped by CAMFED grew up like Fiona did, and she told us about how her family always knew the value of an education.
My parents really wanted me to go to school, and they really worked hard. They made a lot of sacrifices. I remember my mother would risk her life going to the fishing camps along the Zambezi River, where she would get fish, dried fish for resale to the local village people. And she would spend on average a week away from her home and family, sleeping in makeshift huts and dodging wild animals, walking long distances. I remember she couldn't afford normal shoes, so she could only afford plastic sandals. And because of the heat and walking long distances, she would come home with blistered soles, making very little money and saving every cent so that we could go to school.
When you think about education and what it meant to your mother, why do you think she was so passionate about you going to school?
My mother had only finished primary school, so it means she was not literate herself, and there was no other way that she thought we could have a better life except through education. So for my parents, really, education was a way out of poverty for us.
Now you are working for CAMFED, the Campaign for Female Education, but before you worked for them, you were benefiting from them. How did you first connect with this group?
When I was at the risk of not going to continue with my education beyond high school, and I was working as a cleaner within the capital to try and raise some money, and that's when CAMFED took me in to support me through university.
How has your life changed over these past years?
It has meant being able to reach my potential and having so many choices and so many opportunities, which is an opportunity which has been given to every other rural young woman within the CAMFED Association network.
Fiona, there's a couple of interlocking organizations, CAMA and CAMFED. Can you explain what they're both about?
CAMFED, the Campaign for Female Education, is supporting girls in rural Africa to go to school, and has programs across four African countries right now, which is Zimbabwe, Zambia, Tanzania, and Ghana, and this year we'll be expanding into Malawi. And girls who had been supported through school by CAMFED have come together to form an association, and this is called the CAMFED Association CAMA, a network of nearly 8,000 rural young women currently. And CAMA really is a vehicle for transition of rural girls into young adulthood.
Zimbabwe has a long history of really valuing education, but also there's a lot of people who can't afford it. How important is this work today?
It is very important because the current economic situation has meant that so many girls are at the risk of dropping out of school, being required to go and work for food and also for the fees of other children within their family. It also meant that there's so many girls who will be at the risk of contracting HIV/AIDS. So it's very important that girls in Zimbabwe continue to be supported through school. And Comfort is really working hard to supporting more than 13,000 girls to go to school.
You went on to become a lawyer. Tell us about the kind of work you're doing with that law degree.
One of the programs that we do is campaigning against child sexual abuse and challenging rural communities to speak up against child sexual abuse, because there was a culture of silence around that issue. And we worked very hard to empower communities and to empower rural girls to speak up against sexual abuse. And I also had an opportunity to work with rural women and to educate them on laws relating to marriage, inheritance, custody, getting birth certificates for many children who were not registered at their births.
Do you feel like women in the rural areas that you came from in Zimbabwe get a chance to really regularly have enough say, regularly meet their potential?
Within the rural communities, normally, because women are not educated, they do not have the confidence to stand up. They do not have the confidence to have their voice heard. And that is one of the issues that we are trying to address. We'll get to sit within district development committees, who get to participate in community meetings and speak up on issues relating to women. So that, you know, women get their voices heard, because at district level, at rural district level, women don't, because they do not have the literacy skills that give them confidence to stand up and talk about issues affecting them and vulnerable children.
To bring it back to the work that you do, what are you hoping will be the ripple effect when someone who is, say, 6 or 7 right now tries to achieve what you've achieved?
I think it means quite a lot. I can give you an example of the average number that every Kama member is supporting an average of 4 other children to go to school. And together we are supporting over 47,000 to go to school. So this is through just educating one person. In my family, we are 6, and I have 5 siblings behind me. My brother is doing his final year in medical school, and I was supporting him through school. And I think you coming from Zimbabwe, you know that there's a very thin line between immediate and extended family. So I myself support more than 22 people to go to school right now. So that's the ripple effect, that you educate one, and and through that one person, you educate hundreds more people, and contributing to, you know, more years in education for many children. And also the other thing is that you also mobilize, you know, local people to say, we are not just waiting for someone to provide funding to send children to school. And through Comfort's work, you know, local philanthropy has been mobilized through mother support groups at community level, you know, community development committees, which are contributing. They are in their own small ways, you know, doing gardening projects, poultry projects, and using the profits to buy books, simple things like books, shoes that might mean a child would drop out of school because of that. And it's keeping more than 300,000 children in school because of this mobilization.
Fiona, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much.
Fiona Mushimbere is a human rights lawyer from Zimbabwe, and she spoke with us about her efforts to educate girls in Africa as part of CAMFED, the Campaign for Female Education. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Some people dream of taking a road trip to the Grand Canyon, eating pastries in Paris, or exploring the jungles of Brazil. But what about helping kids overseas learn to read and write? Newsweek's national correspondent Allison Samuels did just that. She just got back from the West African country of Ghana, where she spent the last 3 weeks teaching math and English to second graders. Welcome back.
Hi. Good to be back.
We're really excited to hear all about your trip. But, you know, first of all, How did you even decide to do this? What inspired you?
I'd gone to South Africa last year when I did a story on Oprah Winfrey School, and had visited Soweto, and, you know, I gave money because I just sort of felt like I needed to give money, but I felt like that wasn't enough, that I really needed to come back in a different, you know, just in a different way and be more part of the community. Because you give kids money, but, you know, what does that really do? I really wanted to make a bigger impact, and I wanted to do it in a different part of Africa. I wanted to do it in the western part of Africa because that's, you know, primarily where my ancestors would have come from. So, you know, putting all those things together, Ghana just seemed like the best place.
What was it like? What was the first thing you noticed when you got there?
The first thing I guess I noticed was the extreme heat. That was probably the first thing. It was so hot, my God. And then burning, because they burn all of their trash. So you smell the smoke as soon as you sort of get off the plane. Other than that, I guess I just, the friendliness of the people, the, you know, happiness of the people, even given their circumstances, you know, not having some of the simplest things like running water and electricity, still just the joy that you found in everyone's, you know, sort of welcoming of you. That's the part I think that was so amazing to me. And, you know, just walking down the street, there's no sort of fear for your safety. Kids are playing on the street. Kids are running around. I mean, nothing that you would see in the United States at all. You would be so fearful to let your kids do that. But there, you know, there's that sense of community and that safety that, you know, you sort of sense as soon as you sort of hit the town.
So what were the kids like? What kind of kids did you teach? What did you do with them?
I had, I mean, because of the way the school system is, you have to pay and you have to buy a uniform, a lot of kids don't start on time. So I had kids in the second grade who were from 5 years old to 13 years old. And that was sort of a challenge, particularly with some of the older kids. But for the most part, just really adorable kids, very eager to learn. I was teaching them basically their ABCs. And, you know, 1, 2, 3 equals 2, I mean, you know, all those kind of things, just to want, you know, the simple mathematics. I was sort of doing that kind of stuff. And their desire to just know more was amazing. You know, always asking questions, always raising their hands to sort of answer the question, you know, always wanting to know what's a duck, what's a quail, what's all the sort of, what's the, you know, they've seen elephants, but just things that in the Western world that are so, you know, sort of apparent, they didn't know. And they were eager to sort of find out. And that was, you know, I just think all of them, they were incredibly adorable. But for me, the major part for me was giving them pencils and paper. I mean, that was stuff that they didn't have that they were so excited to get. And,
well, how did they react to you as a person? I mean, you're a glamorous Los Angelina. And so what did they think when you showed up?
I think that it's interesting because I was in a program called Cross Cultural Solutions where they send volunteers to different areas. I was the first African American that had been in this school. So I think they were confused. I mean, and even people in the town, they were just like, are you from Ghana or are you Yebo? Yebo is a foreigner and most likely more than usually a white foreigner. But I had a couple of people call me Yebo. But they would sort of ask, like, where are you from? And one of the program's administrators would have to explain she's an ancestor of Africans. And then they would say, oh, okay, so it was definitely some confusing sort of looks that I got. But the kids were, you know, kids are very, you know, easy to sort of get along with. These kids were, you know, absolutely adorable. They didn't understand what I was saying a lot of times, but they really connected to me. I mean, I would bring bubbles and jumping ropes and stuff like that, stuff that they had never seen before. So, you know, I was quite popular at the school, I have to say. I mean, particularly with my bubbles that brought even the junior high school kids out.
Oh, know, I'm sure.
So, no, I felt they really bonded. And when I left, it was just really emotional because I think they didn't quite understand that I wasn't coming back. But, you know, just kept hugging and waving, and they would walk me home, and they called me Sister Alice. They couldn't say Allison. That was a little hard for them. But I was Sister Alice, for better or for worse.
It sounds like you had an amazing time, and yet you mentioned that you were the only African-American, mm-hmm. you know, out of a couple dozen volunteers. Mm-hmm. And why do you think that is? Why, I mean, what's at the root of that? You know, basically a bunch of people who are not of African ancestry going to help out and not people of African ancestry?
Well, I think it's a couple of reasons. I think one is it's a pretty expensive venture. You know, it's a couple of $1,000s, and then when you get there, you have to spend, you know, even more money, and particularly if you want to help the kids out and give them materials and all that kind of stuff. So you spend a decent amount of money. Also, I don't know if a lot of African Americans actually know that this program exists. It's one of those things where you would have to go out and look for it, and it's one of those things that I have talked about, you know, the program sort of getting more information out on programs like yours where African Americans can know that this is an opportunity that they have. I also sort of feel like sometimes our connection to Africa isn't as strong as we'd like to think, and I think that, you know, there's a fear in many ways of sort of going to the motherland and just sort of what that is actually going to sort of turn out to be. Is it going to be what you expected or what you thought it would be? I think there's a lot of fear in that that sort of prevents African-Americans from doing it. But I think it's very unfortunate because it was such a meaningful trip for me. It was so just, I mean, you know, I just felt like, you know, I felt like I was home. It was just full circle. And I think any African-American would get an amazing, you know, an amazing amount of just confidence and just a understanding of just sort of who we are from making that trip.
Now, Ghana was one of the ports of departure mm-hmm. for people coming to the Americas who were enslaved. Mm-hmm. Did you get a chance to follow any of that history?
I did. We actually traveled to Amina, which is where the slave castle, one of the slave castles actually is located. And that was a really an emotional trip, going through the cells and going through the door of no return. And seeing just how small, I mean, it was just, I can't even begin to describe it, particularly as the only African-American. It was really odd. I had to sort of walk away a lot of times as I heard our guide talk about the rape and the torture of the women and of the men, and just the religious aspect of so many sort of Christian people sort of being there while all these things were going on. It was just very overwhelming. But that was probably the most important part of the trip, just actually having that moment to actually, you know, just sort of see where so many horrible things took place and to actually stand in the cells and stand in the holding rooms where you know that your ancestors were and just what that must have been like. I mean, that's all you can do as you stand there is just think what that moment and what that feeling must have been like, not knowing what was going to happen and being put on a ship to go who knows where. They didn't know what was about to happen to them. And when you go to that castle, you totally relive that.
Do you think that there are ways, you know, by sharing an experience like yours, that there will be these connections that are forged more often between Africans and African Americans?
I hope so, because I think that, you know, again, there's a fear of the unknown. And what I'm hoping to do by talking about it and writing about it is just sort of letting people know that it's a wonderful experience, and it's an experience where you can do more than just visit. That was sort of my main sort of reason for wanting to do it. I didn't want to just be a visitor. I wanted to be a part of the community. I wanted to learn the culture. I wanted to feel as though, you know, I was a part of the people, and I actually had a welcome home ceremony that the Queen Mother of the village gave that basically welcomed me back to Africa as an African-American. And that was, like, one of the most beautiful things that I could experience. All the village elders came and presented me with kente cloth and gave me my new name, Imafa, which is peace in Ghana, means peace in Ghana. And it was just this incredible experience, and they were so happy to have me. And the Queen Mother told me I would have a home and land if I ever decided to move back to Ghana. So I'm like, okay.
All right. Well, I'm going to come to your vacation ranch.
Yes, thank
Allison,
you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Allison Samuels is a national correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Her team became the punchline for a bad racial joke, the kind that leaves very deep wounds. We're talking about C. Vivian Stringer, who weathered radio celeb Don Imus calling her team at Rutgers a bunch of nappy-headed hoes. But in addition to dealing with that national controversy, C. Vivian Stringer has survived and surmounted huge obstacles and life-altering tragedies. Now a new memoir tells how one of the most successful coaches in women's sports learned to juggle life and basketball. The book is called Standing Tall, and C. Vivian Stringer is with us now. How are you doing?
I'm fine, Farai. How are you?
I'm doing great. Now, in this book, you only really address the Imus controversy at the end because you have had so many different life experiences. Coal miner's daughter, integrated a cheerleading squad. What did you learn from your childhood?
You know, I learned that you have to stand up. You don't make excuses for the things that you don't have. You have to work hard. Not try to have shortcuts, but you have to be willing to pay the price. And at the end of the day, you know, whatever happens, you must learn to define yourself and use your own measuring stick rather than that of others. And I thought that my parents were tremendous leaders and taught me how to stand up. And that's what I attempt to do with the young people that I'm working with now.
You really spend a lot of loving moments talking about your father, who sacrificed a lot for your family. He was a musician and took a job so that he could support you guys. What did you learn from him?
You know, I honestly felt that that if my father could each day of his life go in a coal mine, risk his life as he did each and every day, and even after by age 45 he had had both of his legs taken off, he still with those prosthetics went into the coal mine. And I learned not to complain and to be grateful for what I have, because he understood responsibility. There were six of us. He understood responsibilities. And being the daughter of a coal miner, the work is hard. But what's most important is that you do everything that you can to keep family together, and you make those kind of sacrifices. And so I learned never to complain about what it is that I didn't have, but to be grateful that I have an opportunity to make something of myself, you know, because as long as you have life in your body and hope in your mind and your heart, that you can overcome any odds and make it in this world.
You've had so much success as a coach, and it really began at Cheney, a historically black college outside of Philadelphia. You came to fame in 82 when you took the team to the national championships. Paint the picture for us. What was going on in your life back then?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I speak in my book about triumph and tragedy. I have not been able to experience great triumph without tremendous tragedy. And so as maybe people looked at me on the sideline and thought, wow, guess what? She's playing for the national championship. This was a school, historically black school, that only had 1,500 students, $1,500, our total year's budget. And here we were playing in the Final Four. We had played – that Final Four consisted of the University of Tennessee, University of Maryland, Louisiana Tech, and ourselves. And to think that this small, historically black school would emerge and rise to the heights that it did was so very special. But in the days that I was practicing, I was actually going back and forth to Children's Hospital in Philadelphia because my daughter, 6 months earlier, had been stricken with meningitis, and quite frankly, we fought for her life. She was still in the intensive care unit, but we fought for her life for about 4 months in a row. It was that I sat there and I thought, I'm so proud of this team, but my heart is so heavy because I really don't know what it feels like to really be triumphant and excited about something, knowing that as clearly as the highest level of enthusiasm that one can have in the participation of sports was the lowest level in my life at that time. And that's what I was experiencing.
And your daughter, Nina, suffered irreversible brain damage. And there's a really beautiful picture of you and her in the book, you standing on the court with her, both wearing your red jerseys. What does she mean to you?
Nina is my life, my world. I touch her, I kiss her every day, and I just thank God because she wasn't supposed to live beyond age 14. And here Nina's 27 years old now. You know, so I've been blessed in many ways. And I think that in a book, what we're trying to say is that, you know, we can complain and we can be hurt about life. But life is, you know, the ups and downs, the triumphs and the tragedies. It is a reflection of just as a basketball court, you win some and you lose some. But the truth of the matter is that we just need to have support and help from one another. Nina gives me my strength, my energy. Anytime that I'm tired, I just look at her. And as I say to my athletes, you know, you may talk about being tired, but you have legs and you have a heart. You have the desire. You can be anything that you'd like. You know, I would do anything, you know, to exchange places with Nina. But I try to learn to try to go on and appreciate the opportunities that I do have in life and try to encourage as many people as I can to know that they can make all things happen.
You're a breast cancer survivor. Your husband passed away. One of your other children was in a serious accident. And yet, when you deal with the IMUS ordeal, you say, I've never felt so powerless in my life. Why did that touch you so much?
You know, Fry, one of the things that that maybe people didn't know is that here I had a team of 10 players, and five of those young ladies were freshmen. Less than a year before that, they were sitting on bleachers at a high school graduation. Some of them that came to me had braces on their teeth. They had dreams and aspirations of becoming doctors and psychologists and musicians and all the likes. And here, while they had done something that they should be commended for, because throughout the year had been a tremendous struggle. They had been pushed to the brink, and yet somehow they survived. And beyond surviving, here they were standing before a national audience and being honored as one of the top two teams in this nation. And I was so proud of them, because I can remember seeing some of them cry or think that they couldn't, and then to see their faces on television or USA Today. And you know, this is what it's all about for us as leaders and as parents and as people that care about our young people, to take them to places that they don't think that they can go, have them accomplish those things, and then with that level of security and confidence, they can take on the world. And this team, you know, had accomplished these great things. And yet, in less than 24 hours of when this event took place, and while we were feeling bad because we had lost, not being able to appreciate at that moment that it was a tremendous feat to play for the national championship, you know, we heard the comments that touched us and hurt us so bad. And the thing that caused tears to come to my eyes is that they honestly asked the question, why? They asked that question, and I thought, you know what? These kids are so innocent that don't we as leaders, don't we as parents, don't we as adults, don't we have a responsibility to protect our young? What society is it?
Unfortunately, Coach, we have to stop here, but I think this is just a testament to the fact that you have an incredible story. Thank you so much.
Thank you so very much.
C. Vivian Stringer holds the distinction of being the only coach in the NCAA history to lead three different women's basketball programs to the Final Four. Her memoir is called Standing Tall, A Memoir of Tragedy and Triumph.